They change cultures. They're heat seekers. They run at adversity and embrace change. These are the Room Tilters.
All right, let's go. Room Tilters podcast. We're back. This is Harry Wilson and DJ Eidson.
Hey, good morning or good afternoon, whenever you're listening to this. Excited to be on the podcast today.
Yeah, we're back, baby. Back to life, back to reality. Here we are, and you know, this is an opportunity for us to now get to know DJ Eidson a little bit. He took some time in the previous podcast to learn a little bit about me in regards to, like, you know, kind of my why and who I am, like, really.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like to do the same thing with DJ. So even though we're co-hosts, I'm gonna play like Mr. Host today on this podcast, and you know, asking questions. Obviously, I've already done my homework on this gentleman, and so I kind of know what we're going to talk about, and I think it's gonna be interesting because it's a topic that you know resides in America today, ultimately. But it's interesting to see how it's affected DJ and who he is and what he's become and what he's looking to become. So I hope you're excited, DJ, because I'm going to grill your ass.
I am.
I'm going to grill you.
Yeah, it is exciting. And like you said, I think, and we had an opportunity to do this with you, is that we just want to get to know each other better and let the audience know who we are. And so this is a really cool opportunity today. So
you're on the hot seat.
I am.
You're on the hot seat. No, but so listen, so you grew up in Northwest Ohio.
Yes, right? Sir.
Yep. Set the scene where you grew up, and let us kind of get us warmed up and lathered up.
Yeah, here. I mean, I grew up in Bowling Green, Ohio. The son of a white mother and a black father in the 80s, and it was an interesting and challenging time because the race relations weren't great then. You didn't see a lot of kind of mixed couples. And so a lot of what I remember as a kid growing up was around that, especially, you know, as a you know, 8-9-year-old kid. You know, a lot of it was like, you're too black, or you're not black enough, or, you know, even things like, you know, I was a tiny kid. I was in eighth grade, I was 5'1". 85 pounds.
With a peanut head.
I still got that.
Like, we were going to, by the way, we were going to call this podcast the Peanut Head Podcast, but we thought it was too specific to DJ, so wow. we thought it would be better to... So anyway, that's just a side note.
No, so, and so you're too short, you're too skinny, you know, we talk about insecurities, you know, there's things that, even I remember as an 8-year-old kid in first grade, one of my classmates saying, "You can't use this drinking fountain." Mm. So I mean, it was
the '80s.
This is the '80s, man. It's the '80s, and so so you really doubt yourself at times. But luckily, I had, you know, two loving parents and a family unit that instilled confidence in me, and made some tough decisions. Like I went from that first grade classroom to pretty much predominantly white environment. To a more multi-race environment in Toledo, which is about a half an hour away. But my parents made the sacrifice to say, "Hey, we're going to drive you up there. And we want to give you a different experience." Again, I had people, whether it was my parents, whether it was a teacher, Mr. McGinnis, played a critical role in not only giving me confidence. At the time, my first grade teacher in Bowling Green pretty much told me, like, "You can't read. Don't bother trying." That was it really isolated me. He was one that I remember. We had our books out, getting ready to do reading class in the second grade, and I didn't open my book. And he looked at me and he said, "DJ, you know, why isn't your book open?" And I looked at him and I said, "Because I can't read."
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me and said, "Well, that's great, because I'm going to teach you how."
That's awesome.
And so that was kind of my first experience in seeing somebody believe in me more than I even believed in myself. And it really stuck with me, because I felt like, you know, even though that happened when I was, you know, 8-9 years old, somebody showing me that confidence before I had it in myself are things that I carry into my own leadership, myself as a father, And so these little tiny experiences as a kid, you know, do play a big role.
Yeah, you know, like this could be like a 7-hour podcast if you want it to be. It's not going to be, because this is just a big topic that, you know, I've always found interesting. You know, obviously, I'm a black dude, grew up in a predominantly white community, but also have, you know, a lot of different kind of variety of experiences and around different people, different ethnicities and backgrounds, etc. I'm married to a lovely white woman. Does that sound weird?
No, it's great, man.
Lovely white woman. Courtney, I love you, sweetheart. You're awesome. And she spells her name like a black woman, though. It's Courtenay. It's Courtenay. So on paper, she's black.
There you go.
On paper, she's black. But the, you know, the point is that, like, it's just all, it's all love, right? It's
That's
all
right.
love. It's all been all love in my family, my community. But I've always wondered what, you know, and also, and oftentimes the Wilsons get misdiagnosed as biracial. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody mm-hmm. assumes one of our parents is white, right? Because mainly because of my brother's hair. And my sister's, you know, light-skinned. That's how you say it.
Black light-skinned.
But she's, so I mean, it gets confusing. But so I've grown up kind of in that, it's seen like kind of this multiracial community, but not being biracial. Like, what right. is that really like? Because, actually, before you tell me that, I do have a question.
Yeah.
So who, as you grew up, where's your, how did you identify? Were you identified? Do you kind of feel like you're a black dude? Do you feel like you're a white dude?
Yeah.
Somewhere in between?
I've always identified myself as black. Mm-hmm. And I think you know, I've been drawn to that, whether it's the culture, whether it's the, just maybe it's just that my father was black, and you know, you always kind of want to be like dad, and so but what's interesting is, like, and I said at the beginning, like, you're too black or you're not black mm-hmm. enough. What's interesting is how people you know, not relate, but how they, I want to say, maybe accept me. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, I'm definitely am different. So yeah, I've always identified myself as someone who's black. You know, again, I don't know if it's because my father's black, and just like any other young boy, you want to be like your dad. I think the world definitely, you know, looks at me as black. And so, you know, but what I've seen, though, is that this unique experience of growing up in kind of this white and black culture, I've been able to learn about both, and over time, and especially at a very even young age, feel comfortable in both settings.
Well, identifying as black, how does that affect your relationship, or did it affect your relationship, or does it now with your mom?
Not at all. Yeah, I think that my mom is, like, she's one of the most accepting, kind, and, like, loving people that I know, has a real empathetic heart, and has always done well working in different cultures. She grew up as a, and came up as a elementary physical education teacher in the inner city. And so, She embraced me for what I was, and I don't think was ever, and never has been, offended that I did identify myself as black.
And I guess that, you know, I don't expect a mother or a father to be offended per se with how you identify as a biracial kid. But what I've always wondered is, she's never been a black boy.
Right.
Your dad has, but he's never been a biracial. He's never had been half white, right? Or if you know what I mean, so, like, it's hard to, like, you can't potentially as mom, I can't really provide, maybe I can't provide real advice to my son that has this experience as a black man, young black man in our community.
Mm-hmm.
So I just, you know, I've always wondered that, and that's not really an answer for you probably.
Yeah.
But, and I, you know, it's more of a, maybe an interesting question for somebody like your mom, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is how did you deal with raising, children that looked different than you, that theoretically may have lived a different kind of life than you,
right? Right.
In the same home.
Yeah. Right. No. I remember my mom as somebody that was always had our back, in that area when somebody did say you can't use that drinking fountain, or they would call us the N-word at school, whatever it was. My mom did so much for us in terms of, mm-hmm. of protecting us. I remember one situation, actually wrote, you know, a letter to the editor in our hometown newspaper, which was a really big deal, and just really called out racism. And she shared that letter with me a couple Christmases ago. I had forgotten or didn't realize that she wrote it, but I think she was a huge advocate. And I think what she taught us there is that you stand up for what is right, no matter how difficult it was. You know, there were times where we would travel. My sister was an All-American in track, and we'd have to go to all these different cities. And there were times where people would not rent hotel rooms to us, where we had to sneak up the fire escape and have my mom be the face of the family to get the hotel, because when my dad went to go rent the hotel room, we couldn't get it.
That's crazy.
So
I mean, those are external people from your family. You know that there's individuals, people, organizations that exist like that, unfortunately. Any of that kind of environment and ecosystem find itself present within your own family?
Yeah, absolutely. Most kids grow up having a relationship with their grandparents. I didn't get to have that opportunity on my mom's side. My mom's parents disowned her when they found out she was going to marry my father. Mm. And so we grew up without grandparents on my mother's side. And so that really bothered me, just knowing that there were people out there that you were related to, cousins, aunts, uncles, grandparents that you had no relationship with. They actually, my grandparents told people in my mom's hometown of, Norwalk, Ohio, that she was dead. Mm. I mean, you know, so imagine the hurt, and pain that would give, any kid. And so that was troubling. There is a situation that I recall as it relates to my grandparents. When I became a pharmaceutical sales intern, you always tease because you said I got in the pharmaceutical industry
when you were 16.
Yeah. So I was a pharmaceutical sales intern, 21 years old, and Norwalk, Ohio was actually my part of my territory. And I remember going into Norwalk, Ohio. You'd have to go, you know, once every couple weeks or whatever to see your customers. And I would sit in these doctor's offices. I was selling Claritin and Nasonex for allergies. And I would sit in these doctor's offices and I would wonder, are these two people, older, you know, white couple, grandparents type age, are those my grandparents? You imagine that, you know, sitting in an office not knowing if these are your relatives or not. And it bothered me so much that I actually went to a local pizza parlor for lunch, and I asked them if they had a phone book at the time, you know, for those who remember phone books. and I looked up my grandparents' names, which is ironic because I had to call my mom to get their name. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know their first name. Mm-hmm. That's how much contact that I had with them. And so I looked them up, looked up their address, and drove up to their house. Mm. And again, I have a suit on, and I'm dressed, and I go up to and knock on the door, and my grandfather answers the door, and he says, "Hey, son, what are you selling?" And I said, "I'm your grandson." And he looks at me, and he goes, "Helen," he goes, "DJ's here."
So he knew you.
It was crazy. They at least knew my name.
Right.
So I went into the house and we sat in the kitchen and we had a conversation. And I had done some praying before this interaction and a lot of thought and there were some Bible verses that were in my mind that I had looked up around judgment. And I knew they were believers. So I brought up some of those Bible verses, you know, and, you know, trying to figure out if we could find a commonality and, you know, how you aren't supposed to judge according to the Bible. And you know, after a half an hour conversation, I remember my grandmother saying to me, she goes, "You know, DJ, you're right." And she goes, "But I'm just old." And she goes, "You know, even the birds are smarter than us." She goes, "You don't see a bluebird, you know, mating with a robin." Mm. And I go, wow, you know? And so it was very interesting how rooted and stuck in their ways they were. I really appreciated that conversation because it helped me put some closure to it. I was able to talk to them about our family and kind of, you know, what my sister, like I said, was an All-American in track, and she at that point had started a family, was very successful. My younger sister was playing Division I basketball, and it was neat to be able to kind of weave that into the conversation so that they could see, you know, that my mom was all right, mm-hmm. you know, and we did okay. Mm-hmm. And to contrast that, you know, there were parts of that side of the family that had a lot of issues, whether it was, you know, drugs, alcohol, divorce, whatever it was, right? Mm-hmm. Things, issues that come up. Mm-hmm. But you know, our family, you know, with my mom and dad was pretty blessed.
Wow. That's wild, man. I mean, this is, you know, this is, we're not in the 40s here, right? Or right. 18 something. Right. This is 19, you know, 80s, 1990 something.
That's right.
Early 2000s? Where was this again?
It was, I was 21 years old. Okay, you're probably talking 1999.
That's crazy. So it really, you know, it really took a lot of courage for you to, at 21 or so, 21 years old, to like walk up to this house and not really know what the reaction would be.
Right.
So tell me about that courage. Did you realize that with how courageous that was? Or were you just like, you know, was that just kind of a blind, like...
Yeah, decision? Yeah. I don't know if I realized how courageous it was at the time. I know that, you know, we talk a lot about preparation before any kind of, you know, sales call or, you know, any kind of big appointment that you have. I had... really prepared, I think, mentally over all those years of like, if you met your grandparents, what would you say? What would you do? Again, like there were certain things that, you know, as a believer and somebody that reads the Bible, that was being called to me, that I was saying, like, that kind of pushed me towards that. And so I don't know if I was looking at it as being courageous. Now, in hindsight, you know, I look at that as probably my most difficult sales call ever, right? And I say sales call, right? But like almost like a cold call where you're going up to somebody and you don't know how they're going to react. And to do that at 21 years old, early on in my career like that, I think it helped me have the courage to be able to go and talk in front of anybody one-on-one like that.
Even though in this quote-unquote sales call, you essentially got a no?
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you're going up there to kind of present who you are, who your family is, and they're still like, yeah, robins, bluebirds is not a thing.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think because if we fast forward, the next time I saw my grandmother was at her funeral.
Oh, wow. I was going to ask you if they're still alive.
So they're both passed.
Oh, wow.
And I went to both their funerals. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was important to do that because it helped give my mother some closure because mm-hmm. she obviously attended too as well. But I don't think that we ever stop exemplifying or leading by example.
Did your father go to the funeral?
That's a great question. No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I he did not. At that point, my parents were married 34 years. At mm-hmm. that point, they were divorced.
Okay, got it. So let me ask you this. This is what I was wondering. Is, let's say you went on that sales call, but you went up to that house, mm-hmm. and they were like, oh, DJ, like, thank God. We were just talking about you. We were praying that you'd come in and like, visit us, and you know, we've been wanting to see you, and come in, like, have a turkey sandwich and some sweet tea. Like, we were so excited to wrap our arms around you.
Right.
Like, how do you think you would have responded? And do you think that would have changed anything?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would have responded the same way in terms of, like, you know, what our conversation was. Of course, I'd want to have a relationship with my grandparents. I would think that would be a great end result. But I don't think it would change, again, my feeling towards them overall. I still love them. Despite what they did to my mother. And yes, it would be great to have a relationship with them, but that was their choice not to do that. I mean, if you look at any relationship, if I give 100% and you give 10%, our relationship's really only worth 10%. Right, you know, I can't make somebody else want to have a relationship with me. But what I can do, I think, again, by leading by example, is demonstrate what good looks like. Mm-hmm. And even when it's really, really difficult. And that was probably one of the most difficult times to do that for me.
Mm-hmm. So what does it all mean now, right? So it's 2019. This, mm-hmm. this was, you know, almost 20 years ago.
Yep.
As far as that, this kind of this meeting with yes. your grandparents, and then of course, you know, you've lived without kind of these grandparents present, you know, all your life. Like, what does it mean wrapped around all the other mm-hmm. pieces on the story that you told us around, you know, going to schools and you know being told you can't read and being told that you look different, you're black, you're too black, you're not black enough, whatever it is. Like, what does it all mean when you weave it together?
Yeah, what I've seen, and again, if we go back to my grandparents and that side of my mom's family, when you limit yourself the opportunity to meet a diversity of people, you limit yourself on your ability to influence and have a really full and successful life. Mm-hmm. And so for me, what most people would deem as, and you know, you said like too black, not black enough, too skinny, whatever it was, like, I was able to be able to go to different schools and have different experiences and be put around different types of people to have a better understanding for people that were different than me. Mm-hmm. I was kind of just thrown into that. You know, mm-hmm. when you're thrown into like almost like a United Nations type of family, all different shades and colors, you are inherently more open and understanding to different cultures. Mm-hmm. And I think that gives you a certain level of influence that you're able to, because you're able to connect with people on a different level. Mm-hmm. And so I don't, like, again, going through it, similar to your story, when you're going through it, it hurts. Mm-hmm. And you're not trying to be like, oh, this is the greatest thing ever. I'm glad somebody called me the N-word. Or I'm glad I got in a fight in the playground because, you know, somebody said you were black and, you know, hit you across the, you know, the back or whatever it was. And it's like, that didn't feel good. But I look back now, and it's really fundamentally shaped who I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So how many schools did you go to?
Yeah, you know, I think it was 11 total. Mm-hmm. When you count, you know, I also went to two colleges. Mm-hmm. But I had gone to several different elementary schools, a couple different high schools. And so, you know, that, when you fast forward into, like, the business world, having to go in and out of these environments and create relationships and very quickly mm-hmm. is something that I just had to do growing up.
Right.
And so I almost, and again, I give my mom a lot of credit for this. When change happened, she would always say stuff like, you get to go to a new school mm-hmm. this year. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to get to make new friends. They got a basketball team. You're going to have new teammates. So she would always, like, this change was never like, oh, I'm going to a new school. I had to look. It didn't until I was an adult and I started telling people, you know, they'd say, where do you go to school? And I would tell them, they're like, dang, you went to a lot of schools.
Yeah.
And so they're like, how was that? You know, and it's like, did you move a lot? You know, no, we stayed in the same house. We just That's went amazing. To different schools. That so, so, but it really has shaped who I am in terms of being able to connect with people quickly. And looking at it as these changes as an opportunity, not as something that's negative.
Right, right. What would you say to Mr. McGinnis, who for the listeners, if they didn't catch that, is the teacher that told you, hey, I'm going to teach you how to read. You know, it's good news. I'm glad, you know, yeah. good news. You can't read. I'm going to teach you. Like, what would you say to him now?
Yeah, you know, thank you. You know, I would tell him thank you. And I've had the opportunity to do that. He mm-hmm. actually... He not only taught me how to read, he brought me to Christ. Mm-hmm. And so that to me was at, you know, 8, 9 years old when I was saved, has been something that I've been able to go to as a real kind of staple for my values that has helped me both in good times and bad. And I have strayed. There's been times where I've gone off the path, but I always knew right because Pastor McGinnis, it was Mr. McGinnis at the time, he ended up becoming a pastor, really taught me a ton and gave me a good foundation in terms of my values and morals.
Yeah.
So, cool. So I would tell him thank you.
Shouts out to Mr. McGinnis. What's up, Mr. McGinnis? You know what I mean? You're on the Room Tilters podcast.
That's right. That's
getting
right.
A shout out. No, but okay. And so just to close out here, there's two things we're going to do. One, I'm going to ask you for a call to action for those that are listening, something that you'd like to hold them responsible for, if you will.
Yep.
And then we're going to lighten it up. At the very end, I'm going to ask you some questions that we have not prepared for at all.
Okay.
You have not prepared for at all.
Good.
Or just to kind of, you know, as a friend of ours that used to manage both of us, we're gonna take our voice up a little bit, which just means that we're just gonna change it up, right? A little falsetto at the top, right?
And, we say shout out to Lou Scurbo.
We can say shout out to Lou Scurbo. He was king of the right? But so I think we're just gonna, you know, take it, make it a little casual, and ask some quick fire questions for you. So,
love it.
First thing is call to action. You know, based on what's, you know, obviously impacted you, what would you tell our audience to, like, what would you hold them responsible for? What's the call to action?
So this week, when something changes or you deem something as adversarial and you come into adversity, I would like them to do two things. Number one, if you see something change, look at it as an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And if you see something is adverse, run at it.
Mm-hmm.
Those are two things. Because, like, I didn't realize I was doing it and I was being conditioned for this as a kid. But I look at every change as an opportunity. And I think that has been a real competitive advantage for me in my life.
Mm-hmm.
There's not too much that you can, and you work with me, right? And we've seen, you've been with me on highs and lows. But I don't get rattled very easily,
mm-hmm.
because I can put things in a real context. I can put things in the context of, like, what it looks like to really be hurt. You
right.
know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you're not going to hurt my feelings by not letting me in the office,
right.
you know, or whatever it is. Like, I know what real pain feels like. And so that helps
me. You've been said no to by family.
By family. Yeah.
Right.
Right. Where it means something, right? Right? You know, like, it's, right. you know, it's not a contract. It's not something. It's people that should really love you and, you know. And don't.
Right. Right. Now, I will say this. The only time that you do get a little rattled is when you haven't eaten.
It's true.
In an hour
it's
or two.
True.
Like,
this I'm man, hungry. I'm very hungry
hangry,
right now.
Hangry. Hangry is the term. So okay. So, listen. To transition, lighten it up a little
yep.
bit to close out.
Yep.
That's a great call to action, by the way. So, thanks for providing that. Okay. Favorite book or author?
Yeah, the Bible.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's really okay. where I go to on a daily basis to seek wisdom.
Awesome.
Written by God.
written by God. Illustrated by God.
Yeah, there you go. That's right. That's right.
All the above. Okay. And then let's do a favorite musician, dead or alive, or band.
Man, there's two. Sorry, like
okay,
I love, and you know this. I love Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson I mean, loves you.
Yeah, that's on another podcast. man, I'm gonna say three. Actually, I love Sam Cooke and Al Green too. I'm kind of like this throwback.
You're an old head.
I am that. 41 years old for the people out there. I really love old school R&B. And my other best friend, Pete MindConnect, introduced me to Sam Cooke. It actually was his father that introduced me to Sam Cooke. And Al Green was just a staple at my wedding. So those are probably my three.
Okay.
So
if you had a last meal, what would it be?
Oh, that's pizza.
Pizza.
Yeah. Like, what you doing? We had it. And with that, hey, that pizza.
You're doing thin crust or are you doing?
You know it's thin crust. Yeah. So no. Shout out to Adriatico's. We just had some Adriatico's
Columbus,
pizza,
Ohio.
Columbus, Ohio. Shout out to Adriatico's. We can hashtag that too on the podcast, but that was some bomb pizza.
This podcast sponsored by Adriatico's. No, it's not.
We'll run that by our legal team.
It's not, but if it is and we can get lifetime supply,
that's right.
That'll work.
That's right.
You know, so O-H-I-O. okay. We'll end with that.
It was good. Thanks for taking the time, man. This was.
No, I mean, I hope that our listeners are getting to know both of us a little better. You know, and this podcast was dedicated to DJ and getting to know him quite a bit more. So we just want to, again, let people know where we come from, and you know, b- both from the standpoint of like our background, but like why we're here, right? And we also want them to remember you don't have to be sick to get better.
You've been listening to the Room Tilters podcast, hosted by DJ Eitzen and Harry Wilson, presented by Limitless Minds.